Right. Oh, thanks a lot. Congratulations, Bill, and thank you for all your help. I remember working with Bill on imidacloprid, and the latest compound we had is that indazoflam, which is still under the brand name is Allion, which is number one product in the horticulture. And when we were doing some ASDA studies, some of the numbers he got in one of the soil, said, Bill, this number looks fairly low. And he would say, Suresh, there is this ionizable proton which will remain in ionic, and it will make a perfect sense why that number, what is supposed to be. And I hope in future also we can make use of your expertise. What I'm going to do today is give some first glimpses of some of the challenges we face in trapping the volatile products in the lab, and then go to the most important subject, which is a bound residue, which is most of the time kind of a mystery, and it depends on who interprets and how you interpret it, because most of the time we don't know what it is. It is not extractable. We call it the non-extractable residue, unextractable residue, and it depends on all over the interpretation. Is it a parent compound? Is it a metabolite? There are some work done to know the identity of those compounds, particularly in USGS, where Kevin Thorne has done some really nice solid-state NMR work to see the identity. But most of the time, we don't know what it is. So when you apply the soil, essentially it degrades with the different routes, mostly with the plant uptake, photolysis, volatilization, and then chemical and microbial degradation. Another thing is absorption of the particles. So today I'm going to concentrate on volatilization and most of the things on the bound residue on the absorption of the particles. So the case study we did is a old compound called a methimidophos or monitor. And we were given the studies to a couple of contract labs to conduct the studies. All these studies done are radio labeled. And the total accountability from both the contract lab came out to be less than 50%. Most of the time, for you to accept a study, you have to have the accountability between 90 to 110% of C14 labeled. So it's a pretty unique case, and then we took it. And this is a typical anaerobic aquatic design. What you do is you take the soil or sediment, and you flush this with nitrogen for a while and incubate it so that you generate the anaerobic conditions. And the way you can find that out by measuring the dissolved oxygen in water or the redox potential of it. Based on the negative value, you know that your system is anaerobic. And then you apply the C14 and then incubate. And then once you start taking sampling point, what you do is you take the flask and you then collect all the volatiles. Usually we use ethylene glycol, methanol for the volatiles, and KOH for any CO2. And majority of the time, this design works. And we did it. And then you decant the water and use the sediment extract, mostly with acetonitrile water or methanol water or any of the organic solvents you think proper. Radioassay, and whatever you want extract, you combust this in Haru oxidizer. And all these numbers for extraction volatiles should be between 90 and 110%. Now, even the new study, we counted the same balance. After about 14 days, our mass balance was less than 60%. So, since my training was in organic chemistry, I thought since we are labeled at this position, the most probable metabolite is probably methane thiol or disulfide, and that was my first suspicion. So I thought if that is the case, all I have to do is use a trapping solution, mercuric acetate, because it will zap any of this, and I will be able to get the accountability. And we did it, and there was absolutely nothing. So at that time, I realized it must be something else, because since it's anaerobic conditions, the most likely will be CH4. And we have seen methane gas production in our studies, but not in this kind of amount. This is, I'm talking about, huge amount of methane was found because our accountability was almost 50%. So rest has to be something else. So we thought if methane is the problem, then we can just take that gas, oxidize it, combusted to CO2, and then they measure the activity. So, and this is, so we thought we can do it. This is, for those of you who have used the Harvey oxidizer, this is nothing but a tube containing the quartz, platinum wire, and these two catalysts, silver vanadate and copper oxide. This is typically based, if you take any Harvey oxidizer, this is what you'll find it. The gas goes from here, combust it, and gets to CO2. So we took a glass tube and built it. And before I, to know whether the system works, I thought of making a methane gas and look at the efficiency, whether the system is working or not before using for the real system. So what we do is we can buy this methyl iodide from Aldrich Chemicals, which is fairly easy, and treat with lithium aluminum hydride. And this reaction is very instantaneous, so, and it's very quantitative. So you make the methane gas, you pass through the system, combust it to CO2, and then trap it in the CO2. And when I checked the system, I essentially got 99% efficiency. So at this stage, I know this system is working. If there's a methane gas, I will be able to quantify it and combust it. And then what we did is we took the flask and conducted to the KOS trap to get any CO2 and any sulfuric acid, there's a volatile amino compound, and that was connected to the heating oven. And this, usually we heat this about 680 degrees centigrade so that all the gases combusted, and then trap it in the cocktail and measure it. And this is what it typically looks like. You take the flask, and these are the traps, and this is the heating oven where you can see the temperature. Usually we'll do about 680 degrees, and then here what the glass tube is, and then trap the all the CO2 produced in this scintillation wire and count by LSC. And we got an excellent result. The new study really, material balance was achieved. And post-volatile were trapped. But at this stage, if somebody has asked me, how do you know it's a methane? It can be ethane, it can be propane, it can be butane, it can be any volatile gas. All I have showed at, up to this stage is taken a gas, combust it to CO2, and measure the CO2. But if somebody asked me the identity of the gas, I had no idea what it is. So then we realized if we take this head space from here and analyze the RAGA. RAGA stands for radioactive gas analyzer. It's essentially gas chromatography, which then whatever gas comes goes to the radioactive detector and you can analyze it. So we took the headspace gas and injected in the RAGA, and we got two peaks, two major peaks. And then I synthesized this CH4 or methane gas and injected, and it exactly matched with the larger one. So at this stage, we know it is a methane gas. We can tell for surety. Then I was a little curious, maybe what find out what it is. We know it is a CO2, but I thought we may be able to analyze that also. So we got some sodium carbonate from Aldrich, had a drop of hydrochloric acid, which generates CO2 instantaneously, and injected, and it exactly matched that CO2. So at this stage, we know what are the, both the compounds, whether it's methane and the CO2. So then, if you look at the compound with methamidiphos, which degrade really, really well. And then these are the accountability we found out. I mean, it came down, go up. And then around this particular point, about 60 days, it kind of went down again. And we are curious where in the world we are, what is happening here. I don't know if this is very clear for this picture. What happens is we used to take the gas from all over here, and if you look at this, there are pockets of gases in the sediment. So the gases were trapped even in the sediment, and we were not looking at it. And according to guideline, if you want to do the study, one of the things they say is do not disturb the sediment. But for this case, I was more worried about the accountability rather than the disturbing the sediment. And then we disturb this sediment, we got an additional 10 to 15% of methane gas, which was trapped in the sediment. So once that we got an extremely good balance. And the major volatile, which is methane gas, it accounted for almost 66% of the applied activity. And I have not seen any compound in my last 25 years of life having that kind of methane gas in the laboratory studies. And we confirmed it, and the overall accountability was improved between 88 to 90%. And now I'm going to get into the fun project, which is a non-extractable or the bound residue, or some people call unextractable residue. As I said, since it is non-extractable, it all depends on the interpretation of every individual. And there are a few definitions. What is bound or what is non-extractable? Whatever chemical species originating from pesticides that are non-extractable by method, which do not significantly change the chemical nature of the residue. This is very important, because that means you are not supposed to use extremely harsh conditions to get the compound. So whatever is not extracted with this method has been said as a bound residue. And there is a Fritz Fuhr, a German scientist, he retired long back, but he has done some tremendous amount of work in this area, and this is what his definition is. Bound residue represents compounds in soil, plants, or animals. The extraction method must not substantially change the compound themselves or the structure of the matrix. So what are the bound residues? The bound residue can be covalently bound, which is not extractable, or can be non-covalently bound, which can be reversible binding. And non-extractable or unextractable residues in the laboratory degradation studies left after the extraction using organic solvents, water at ambient and high temperature. Now, there are a couple of types of bound residue. One is biotic, which results from the microbial degradation. And the second one is what you call non-biotic, which can just happen with the physicochemical interaction of your compound with the soils. And it's fairly easy to differentiate that if you conduct the study with a sterile soil and non-sterile soil. Sometimes you can distinguish whether it's a biotic or non-biotic. So studies we are doing mostly for the environmental fate one lies aerobic, anaerobic, of course photolysis, ASDAS, which is the most important studies which gives us the indication of the leaching of the compound, and terrestrial field dissipation. And in fate in water, we'll conduct usually hydrolysis, photolysis in water, and aerobic and anaerobic aquatic one. And these studies where we face the bound residue depending on the chemicals we use. At the end of the day, it is not the bound residue that is the problem. It is the risk assessment. Because if you cannot extract it, the agency nowadays takes all bound residue as the compound available or the parent equivalent and does the risk assessment. And that is what the main issue is. So our typical extraction consists of mostly 3-4 extraction at room temperature, either with acetonitrile water or methanol. And then we do a couple of ACE extraction or micro extraction. And then whatever remained, we will oxidize it. And this is a typical laboratory extraction procedure. And most of the time you can extract whatever material available with these kind of solvents. And then if the compound is more, it's like an old one, you treat this with sodium hydroxide and fractionate into fulvic acid, humic acid, and humic. But these are the very harsh conditions. You have to use about 0.5 normal sodium hydroxide. And this really doesn't represent what is the nature, exact nature of the compound in the soil. So the problem is now what? This is a presentation from EPA. The registrant gave them the data and said, okay, ethyl parathion, the DT50 is about 32 days. And this is what they gave. And then the EPA found out they got this much of bound residue, then they recalculate the half-life, and their half-life went from 32 to 162 days. This is actually the presentation from David Jones of EPA. So essentially they recalculate the half-life, and then it affects the risk assessment. So then there is, if you show to them in the past, if your bound residue is abiotic and not biotic, then you did get the their approval. For example, we had a compound called parasulfitol, and it bonds tremendously. I mean, we use all kinds of solvents, and we can see the bond residue. And then what we did is we conducted its metabolism in the sterile soil. I know there are a lot of expertise in the room. There are different ways of making the soil sterile. The old-fashioned way is to autoclave it, which essentially kills the microbe, but it also disturbs the soil matrices, which is really not good. Then the other one is we can use mercury, chloride, and chemicals. But the best way to do is you can use a gamma rays, gamma radiation, if you cobalt-60 source, and use the gamma radiation and kill the microbes itself without disturbing the soil matrix. And the dose, you have to use it fairly high, because if you use about 1 megarad, it can kill only the fungi. If you want to kill all the bacteria, you have to use essentially 4 megabit or 4 kilobytes. And that is what we did. We sent our soil to Florida, where they have the atomic plant, and then they irradiated. And you can see the difference, the bound residue in the non-sterile soil, we have 28% and about 0.7%. Even at the end of the day, I mean, end of the study, 120 days, we had about 50% bound residue in the non-sterile versus the sterile soil. And EPA accepted this data and say, yes, we have proved us that it is a non-biotic, and then they give us the approval. But then last year they came with some new guidance. This is just, they said, the main issue is the submitted degradation study, the solvent system used to extract residues from soil do not typically include both polar and non-polar solvents with sufficiently wide range of chemical properties. And they are right in this. I'm not blaming them, because most of the time, if you look at the lab studies, all they use is one or two types of solvents, and then they say the bound residue. And they have to deal with the uncertainty, and they have to deal with all this Greenpeace and other things trying to sue them that, well, you know, give a registration to this compound. So I cannot find a fault with them. So they came out with the guidance, and they gave us, say, you have to use solvents from at least one solvent from each group. And if you look at it, most of our was belong to this group, either it's acetonitrile or it's methanol. This is the, and water, this is the one we have been using. And they said, no, this is, they based it on the, what is called a dielectric constant. And then they said, okay, you have to use a solvent from group 2 and group 3 also. So in the current studies, what we are doing, these are the last 6 compounds in development. And you can see, these numbers are from, you know, goes from day 0 to 120 days. So you can see the extractability going down. But majority of the residues you can extract from these solvents. There is no question about it, either ACN or methanol. We also did the microwave extraction, a couple of them with isotonitrile water and with methanol, and we got some of it. And then we used these two groups, ethyl acetate and hexane, and you can hardly see any extractability. And the, you know, if you look at this number, this is nothing but a dilution factor. It has nothing to do with the solvents. So when we, after this stage, whatever we have, you cannot extract from simple, I mean, the organic solvents like ethyl acetate and hexane at all. So the question is, if you cannot extract from these conditions, even in the lab, even in the hard condition, how can it get extracted with this water and calcium and other things? So the question is where the residue goes. Are these bioavailable to the plants or other organisms? Are they available for leaching to the groundwater? Are they available for further microbial degradation? And I hope at the end of the talk, I'll be able to answer each one of these questions. So some of the studies which are done in the lab, you can see, this is the work done by, again, Prince Pure. Whether to check the bioavailability, what they have done is they have taken this different compound, benzothiazoram, metamiron, cimazine, anilazine. And what they have done is they applied the compound with the soil, new applied, and also with the aged soil, that the bound residue was there. And you can see the uptake of the bound residue in all the roots and leaves. is very minimal. It's less than 1% of the boundary residue. So it is not available to the plants. Then they went and did some earthworm studies, and the results are essentially saying this was a heterogene and isoproton. You can see from the bound, there's hardly any residues uptake in the organism. So as an organic chemist, I always used to think soil as a dirt with few microbes. And that was whole my idea of soil. And then I went and digged in the literature and found out it's an extremely complex material. It is humic acid, fulvic acid, and humin. And when I looked at the structure of humic acid, and this is the simplest structure, by the way, this is not the complex one, this is the simplest structure done by spectroscopically. I just couldn't believe it. I mean, if you look at this, this is like a bonanza for you people who call it the quinone here, and we used to call it the Michael acceptor. Anything can be applied here, captured. And look at these moieties. Look at this unsaturated ketone and other things. Any chemicals which will come into this contact, it will be zapped. And as I said, I'm just showing the structure of simple humic acid. Humine and fulvic acid is the structure of more complex. So then went further and found out that particularly in environment, there's a lot of lignin factors. And what is, for example, like conferil, catechol, other things, and all they do is oxidize them. If you have any amino compounds, say, for example, dichloroaniline or anything compound, it forms the bond, and this then is oxidized and goes to what is called a Schiff's base. And the only way you can break that bond to release this aniline is to reflux with sodium hydroxide and then steam distill. That means for the farmer to release that one, he has to spray the soil with Drano and probably use the acetylene starch to get the compound. Otherwise, they are not going to get it. So this is an old one. So what happens is then, where we are using pounds and pounds of this material, where it ends up, if it doesn't, it is not bioavailable. It's not. And this is a classical picture which gives birth. What happens is essentially, if you look at it, it forms the organic matter of the soil. And that is where your most of the pesticides ends up. And that's why it is not available as much as you think it will be. So then we have one of the compounds where the bound residue became really big one. And then we thought, probably if we take the bound residue and mix with the fresh soil, will it release? And the answer is yes. We took this soil incubated C14 test substance and incubated for about 119 days. And we got a fair amount of bound residue. Then we took that bound residue and mixed with the fresh soil. And we released even 25% more of the CO2. And similar work has been also reported by folks from Dow and other things. So if you take the bound residue and mix with the fresh soil, it does release the CO2 for the wonder story. And one of the experiment going on in my lab currently is I was conducting a study. This is an aerobic study in the Sanger soil from California, and this compound is very notorious. It binds essentially, I got about 50% bound about day 7 to day 14. And then we thought probably maybe we should extend it and see whether the bond is probably released. And we kept on going on, and you can see bond is going down and the CO2 is going up. So it does, even though it's a bond on the microbe, does release it to CO2, albeit slowly, and it doesn't accumulate in the environment. So then, in conclusion, what I would say, most of the bound residues, which incorporates into humic acid and humin, they form the biopolymer and becomes part and parcel of organic matter of the soil. So the tightly or covalently bound residue has very low probability of being released into environment. And the bound residue mixed with fresh soils, it does degrade into CO2, thus minimizing its accumulation. And the extraction procedure used in the lab nowadays, we can say, it accounts for more than appropriate to evaluate the residue which may be released in the environment. And so I would say relax, there are tons of them in the acre. And I think I have some time, maybe 5 minutes. to answer any questions. Well, the atrazine, I mean, I remember I showed you the one of the slides. The atrazine is a compound. Even if you do studies with biotic or non-biotic, it will be physicochemical bound. You will not find the difference. But the question is the amount released. The based on all the things, amount released in the environment or the leaching you are talking about. Because this all, everything depends on the relative numbers. Yes. I do agree with you. Everything depends on the relative numbers. But if you look at the number of tons of pesticide they're using in this country or anywhere, you would have thought that it has to go somewhere, but it does form the part of the soil. But I'm not disagreeing with you. There may be some portion which may be going. There's no question about it, yeah. And that's why we have all this monitoring and other studies. Yes?
The previous question assumes that it's all still in parent form.
Yes. Absolutely right. Yeah, I totally agree with you. Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
But that's the fallacy. That's what EFED is doing.
Yeah.
Assuming it's all in a parent
form. Yeah, I mean, I hope with this new guidance and we are using and showing them that it is still not acceptable, I hope they will be accepted. Otherwise, you are absolutely right. You will give the compound and say DT50 is about 50 days and they will come out and it's about 1,000 days and things like that. But at the same time, they are also, you know, kind of, they have to feel also comfortable that, you know, that registrants has done good faith effort to convince them, because they are after the other groups are after them, you know, all the time. So, and that is the dilemma. Go ahead.
You could also make an interpretation that it becomes part of this very resistant organic structure within the soil.
Yeah. If you look at the functionality of this humic acid and other thing, I mean, it essentially forms the biopolymers and forms the organic matter, and that's the reason it is not bioavailable that much. I'm not saying that residue is not there. The residue is there in the form of a polymeric form, or a very huge molecule, and that's why it doesn't take up or doesn't, you know, go into environment. That's the whole point. Okay.
Well, just a quick question. On the EPA method, when they have to use the non-polar solvent?
Yeah.
They require that the soil be moist rather than just a straight organic solvent.
Excellent point. Only the soil scientists can ask this question, because if you're organic chemist, because if you look at me, all my studies I've done ethyl acetate and hexane, and if you take a soil and treat with ethyl acetate, all you'll find is the globules, because EPA method doesn't say that. That's why we put those solvents at the end part of it where we have got all the water and method. Otherwise, it's a disaster if you use... If you take the regular soil and use ethyl acetate, all you'll find is the globules. You cannot extract anything. Yes, excellent question, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
More of a waste of time and
yes. Yeah, to answer your question, I've been involved with EPA on bound residue. I had a couple of conferences in ACS. And then what my next thing is, I talked to people from Syngenta also that take this data from different lab. And all the compounds are shown, they are not one type of chemistry. They are totally different type of chemistry, because if you just take one type of chemistry and showed it to them, oh, that it is not accepted, it is not convincible. We have to make sure that our data is that, yes, we have conducted with a different type of chemical compounds, and all of them shows that after these few extractions, we are not getting much. And that is our hope. Maybe I will talk with Al Barefoot at DuPont and probably have one conference with, where EPA get involved, and hopefully they will be convinced and it will be avoided. But at this stage, it's just a waste of time, but we have to do it just to convince them. Thank you. Really appreciate it.